Let's talk about the child presenting with near-fatal asthma. As soon as he is brought in, you will recognize him. He'll either be obtunded, agitated, confused, or fighting against the oxygen mask, and he will probably need to be intubated. While the equipment is being set up, see if he can tolerate an albuterol treatment. If not, order parenteral therapy with epinephrine or terbutaline. Then administer IV steroids. Now, is he getting better, staying the same, or getting worse? If you are not sure, based on his level of consciousness, look for other signs. Is he as diaphoretic as he was before? Is his muscle tone still poor, or is it better? If he is not better and isn't getting worse, administration of Heliox may delay the need for intubation by decreasing the work of breathing while the other medications are beginning to take effect. Another thing you can try is bilevel positive airway pressure. This provides intermittent assisted ventilation, which helps to abort or delay the need for tracheal intubation. For infants and small children, Heliox and BiPAP are probably not viable options. So, if they are not getting better, intubation is indicated. For older children in whom these measures have failed, intubation is definitely in order. Critical points regarding tracheal intubation in patients with life-threatening asthma are these. 1. Adequate sedation is a must. Most experts think ketamine is the agent of choice for severe asthmatics. The initial dose is 0.5 to 1.5 mg per kilogram, repeated 20 minutes later. Atropine should also be given because ketamine increases bronchial secretions. The dose is 0.01 mg per kilogram, with a minimum dose being 0.1 mg. 2. Paralyze the patient with succinylcholine or vecuronium. If you use succinylcholine, you will need to pretreat with atropine. If you sedated with ketamine and used atropine 0.01 mg per kilogram to reduce bronchial secretions, you need to administer another 0.01 mg per kilogram dose. But if you did not use atropine because you were using another sedating agent, then you need to administer a full dose of atropine, 0.02 mg per kilogram. 3. Immediately following intubation, check correct placement by visualizing the tube past the vocal cords. Listen for adequate breath sounds in all lung fields. Watch the chest wall rise and look for condensation in the tube. Confirm correct placement using one of the following devices or measurements: a qualitative end-tidal CO2 detector, an esophageal detector device, dynamic pulse oximetry readings, or quantitative and continuous CO2 measurements using capnometers or capnographs. 4. Once correct tube placement has been confirmed, inject an albuterol dose directly in the tracheal tube because the patient may not have inhaled an adequate amount of this agent prior to intubation. Now let's move on to the treatment protocols for cardiac dysrhythmias that occur in infants and children. Clinically significant bradycardia is a heart rate less than 60 that most often results from hypoxemia. Therefore, initial therapy is aimed at ensuring adequate ventilation and oxygenation. Bradydysrhythmias that are unresponsive to these measures are treated with epinephrine, unless the bradycardia is vagally mediated, in which case atropine is the drug of choice. The dose of epinephrine is 0.01 mg per kilogram of the 1 to 10,000 solution, repeated every 3 to 5 minutes as needed. Epi can also be given through the tracheal tube at a dose of 0.1 mg per kilogram of the 1 to 1,000 solution. Atropine should be used instead of epinephrine in the presence of AV block or increased vagal activity, such as a rapidly dropping heart rate that may occur during attempts at intubation. Before giving atropine, rule out hypothermia as a cause of the bradycardia, and make sure that oxygenation and ventilation are adequate. The dose of atropine is 0.02 mg per kilogram. The maximum single dose allowed is 0.5 mg in children and 1 mg in adolescents. The hazard of a low dose is paradoxical slowing of the ventricular rate, which would necessitate temporary pacing. Supraventricular tachycardia is often well tolerated for long periods of time in children. The rate is age-dependent and varies from 220 to 300 in infants, greater than 180 in children, and between 150 and 250 in adolescents. Initial treatment in the stable child should consist of vagal maneuvers, induction of the diving reflex, which is particularly sensitive in infants and young children, is one technique that is often effective. To do this, apply an ice pack on the child's face or briefly immerse his face in a basin of cold water. Other vagal maneuvers, such as carotid massage and gagging, may also be tried. If unsuccessful, the next step in the hemodynamically stable child with a narrow complex SVT is drug therapy with adenosine, which is the drug of choice. The initial dose is 0.1 mg per kilogram rapid IV push, with a maximum of 6 mg, followed by a flush of normal saline. If this fails to convert the rhythm, repeat the dose at 0.2 mg per kilogram. If the SVT persists, a third dose using 0.3 mg per kilogram may be given. The maximum single dose should not exceed 12 mg. And remember, adenosine must be administered rapidly IV push to be effective. If adenosine fails to work and the patient is still hemodynamically stable, other agents may be tried, but they have their drawbacks. Verapamil has been shown to have disastrous side effects in infants, such as hypotension, profound bradycardia, and even asystole. Therefore, verapamil should not be used to treat SVT in infants or in children with congestive heart failure, myocardial depression, those on beta-adrenergic blockers, or with a bypass tract. If you use it, the dose is 0.1 mg per kilogram. Procainamide and amiodarone are alternative agents that are acceptable and possibly effective. Only one agent should be used, however, and it should not be used concurrently with any agent that may prolong the QT interval, which is most of the blockers. In children with Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome and a wide complex SVT, verapamil and other blockers can increase conduction through accessory pathways and thereby increase the ventricular rate. Verapamil is also contraindicated in ventricular tachycardia, as well as in children less than a year old, because cardiovascular collapse has been associated with its use in these circumstances. Therefore, to avoid complications, all wide complex SVTs should be treated with amiodarone or procainamide in the stable child, and hemodynamically unstable children should be cardioverted with 0.5 joules per kilogram, regardless of the width of the QRS complex. If the initial attempt to cardiovert is unsuccessful, then double the dose and try again. Premature ventricular contractions in kids are only treated if they are frequent. The drug of choice is lidocaine, and the dose is 1 mg per kilogram IV. The treatment of ventricular tachycardia is determined by the child's clinical condition. If the child is unconscious or hypotensive, DC cardioversion at 0.5 joules per kilogram is indicated. If the rhythm persists, check to see if it is torsade de pointes. If so, administer IV magnesium 25 mg per kilogram slowly over 10 to 20 minutes. 50 mg per kilogram can be used for older children, especially the preteen and adolescent patients. If torsades is not present, attempt DC conversion again at 1 joule per kilogram. If the child is conscious and normotensive, obtain a 12-lead ECG and a careful history, looking especially for a reversible cause such as drug toxicity, electrolyte imbalance, or hypothermia. If a pharmaceutical agent is used to convert the rhythm, In the absence of a reversible cause, amiodarone is probably the best choice, 5 mg per kilogram over 20 to 60 minutes. Alternative agents are procainamide at 15 mg per kilogram over 30 to 60 minutes, or lidocaine, 1 mg per kilogram over 2 to 4 minutes. The child with ventricular fibrillation should be defibrillated at 2 joules per kilogram. Double the dosage if initial defibrillation is unsuccessful. The paddle size for infants is 4.5 centimeters. For the older child, use a paddle with an 8 to 10 centimeter diameter. Pediatric shock may be difficult to assess if one relies on the blood pressure measurement. When the blood pressure drops, it will drop fast because peripheral vasoconstriction and tachycardia both tend to maintain blood pressure until late. The clue to ongoing blood loss and progressive shock is a rising pulse rate. The rule for obtaining IV access in the child with shock is anything, anywhere. The external jugular is a good spot if you can get it, especially in older children and adolescents. Be careful not to insert the needle or catheter beyond the level of the clavicle. If the child has injuries to the chest or upper extremities, try to obtain an IV line in a lower extremity. If the child has abdominal injuries, go for an upper extremity vein. If a peripheral vein cannot be accessed with a large bore catheter, cannulation of the femoral vein is the procedure of choice in infants and young children. If a central line cannot be rapidly established, a saphenous cutdown or interosseous infusion should be done. The anterior tibia, just below and medial to the tibial tuberosity, is the preferred site for intraosseous infusions. The IV fluids of choice in pediatric shock are Ringer's lactate or normal saline. 20 cc's per kilogram, administered over 5 to 20 minutes, should be given. If the child is still in shock after 3 boluses, order packed red blood cells in the amount of 80 cc's per kilogram. An additional 2 boluses of fluid can be given if needed while awaiting blood. If packed RBCs are given, warm them first and then give 10 cc per kilogram boluses according to patient response. In children with a serious isolated head injury, the IV should be keep open only in the absence of shock. If shock is present, use normal saline. More importantly, if shock is present, you are not dealing with an isolated head injury. There are other injuries as well. Look for them. Shock treatment takes precedence over treatment of head injury. If in fact you are dealing with an isolated head injury and there is an altered level of consciousness, obtain a CT scan and contact the neurosurgeon. Hyperventilation is no longer routinely recommended. However, if there are definitive signs of increased intracranial pressure, such as transtentorial herniation, hyperventilation to a PCO2 of 35 millimeters mercury is certainly justified, and it should be done because it is the fastest way to reduce intracranial pressure. If furosemide, mannitol, or hypothermia are used, it should be in consultation with the neurosurgeon. Mannitol is administered IV in a dose of 0.5 to 1 gram per kilogram over 10 to 15 minutes. The dose of furosemide is 0.5 to 1 milligram per kilogram. Hypothermia induction is a last-ditch effort to reduce intracranial pressure when all other measures have failed. Children with blunt abdominal trauma have a 50 to 70% chance of having other associated injuries. Be sure to examine these kids carefully. One method of determining the presence of intra-abdominal bleeding is to take serial girth measurements. An expanding abdomen that is measurable is a reliable sign of continuous abdominal bleeding. Diagnostic peritoneal lavage is a more precise method for detecting intra-abdominal bleeding. DPL should be considered for the hemodynamically unstable child or one with an unreliable abdominal exam. For example, a child with head or spinal cord injury who also has a history or physical findings which suggest the possibility of an intra-abdominal injury. It is performed with 10 cc's per kilogram of Ringer's lactate. Aspiration of more than 5 cc's of free blood or the presence of 100,000 RBCs per cc of lavage fluid is considered positive. Computed tomography is the modality most often used to evaluate a child who has sustained significant abdominal trauma but maintains stable vital signs. However, abdominal ultrasonography may provide important information early in the course of management. Data from the adult literature shows that the sensitivity for detection of intraperitoneal fluid is high, ranging from 85 to 98%, and will likely become a part of pediatric trauma protocols in the near future. The management of poisoning and overdose in adults, as well as in children, continues to change. A critical decision is whether to give Ipecac, activated charcoal, and/or perform gastric lavage, or do none of the above. If the ingested substance is known to be non-toxic and the child is alert, removal is not usually necessary. However, if the agent ingested is known to be toxic, or there is some question as to what the child ingested, activated charcoal, gastric emptying, or both may be indicated. Administration of activated charcoal has become first-line therapy in GI decontamination and is most effective if given within 1 hour. While the use of Ipecac has become controversial, it is still considered an option in the alert child who ingested a moderate or highly toxic agent within 60 minutes of presentation and for which there is no contraindication to emesis. If there is any doubt as to how to proceed, contact Poison Control for the most current recommendations. If Poison Control is not available to you at the exam, make a reasonable decision and explain your rationale to the examiner. A reasonable explanation of your choice is likely to be acceptable. Gastric lavage should be considered in children known or suspected to have ingested agents within 60 minutes of presentation that are highly toxic, or in those who have ingested a toxic or potentially toxic substance that is not absorbed by charcoal, such as iron or lithium. And lavage should also be used in any child who is not alert or who does not have an intact gag reflex. Airway protection is a must in lavaged patients. If emesis is indicated, the dose of Ipecac is 10 cc's in infants 6 to 12 months, 15 cc's in children 1 to 12 years old, and 30 cc's in children over 12. If the child does not vomit after this dose, repeat it, and encourage the child to drink several cups of water and then walk him around the room. Increased activity promotes emesis in most kids. If there is still no vomiting, gastric lavage is indicated if the agent ingested is highly toxic, such as a calcium channel blocker or cyclic antidepressant. Use a 15 to 28 French orogastric tube in children, choosing the largest one that can be easily passed. Smaller tubes may not recover large pill fragments. When inserting the gastric tube in an alert child with an intact gag reflex, place him on his right side with the head lower than the body to minimize the risk of aspiration. If the child is not alert and has a depressed or absent gag reflex, intubation is necessary prior to lavage. The comatose child always needs to be intubated prior to lavage. When lavaging, use isotonic or 1/2 isotonic physiologic saline that is warmed. In a child, lavage in small amounts, 10 cc's per kilogram, to prevent passage of the stomach contents into the small intestine where it can be absorbed. Contraindications for the use of Ipecac and gastric lavage are ingestions of caustics or strong acids, low viscosity hydrocarbons because they are easily aspirated, and non-toxic substances. IV fluid therapy in children is not difficult to remember if you use a few simple guidelines. First, the rate for maintenance fluids is as follows. 4 cc's per kilogram per hour for the first 10 kilograms, 2 cc's per kilogram per hour for the next 10 kilograms, and 1 cc per kilogram per hour for the remaining kilograms. So, for a 10-kilogram child, this is 40 cc's per hour. A 20-kilogram child would receive 60 cc's per hour, and a 30-kilogram child would receive 70 cc's per hour. Second, children who are hypoglycemic should be given a glucose solution. Infuse 2 to 4 cc's per kilogram of 25% glucose, or use a 10% glucose solution and give 5 to 10 cc's per kilogram. Third, children with shock or burns should be given Ringer's lactate. For the burn child, estimate the percent of body burned by using the Lund and Browder charts. Multiply that number times the weight in kilograms times 4, and you have the amount of fluid required in the first 24 hours, starting from the time the burn occurred. Give 1/2 of this amount in the first 8 hours and the second half over the next 16 hours. Daily maintenance fluids need to be administered as well. And always remember to order a pediatric microdrip IV setup. This completes the pediatric resuscitation review. Drug therapy for pediatric cardiac arrest was reviewed in the first CD.